This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary in room 343 at 1 o'clock on May 1st, 1989. We'll be conducting a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bills 667, 971, and House Bill 2667. And we'll be conducting public hearings on Senate Joint Resolution 33, Senate Bills 444, 447, 690, 729, 846, 854, 910, and 936.
I need to make some announcements, folks. First item on the agenda will be Senate Bill 667. And then we'll move to, as a courtesy, Senator Jim Hill's bill, Senate 910, and Senate SJR 33. And then we'll deal with death penalty issues, and then we'll deal with the drug paraphernalia, and finally the issues in terms of surrogacy, which would be 854. So let's move ahead then with Phillipson revenue for this one. Okay, Senator Bradbury. And whoever you're.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, Bill Bradbury, State Senator, District 24. I'm joined this afternoon by Sheriff Earl Tarno, who is the president of the Oregon State Sheriffs Association. And we were both here not too long ago in front of you last week. So it's a pleasure to be back.
Yes.
I wanted to just briefly give you kind of what inspired the introduction of Senate Bill 667. It is very clear, and I'm sure all of you are aware of it, that those people who are convicted of sex crimes, who are sex offenders, have a very high recidivism rate to repeat their crime again. The other thing that we know about sex offenders is that they tend to have a fairly common mode of operation in their sex offense. There is a similarity between their crimes. This bill proposes that every sex offender who's convicted of a sex offense would be required to register, and that would be that information that person is in the community would be available to law enforcement. It would not be available to the general public, and I think that's a real key point. We're not trying to put a little sticker up on your doorstep says you're a sex offender. What we're trying to do is makes that information available to law enforcement. If there is another sex crime in the community, they would be able to check the registration, look for similar modes of operation, and check. It would be sort of the first list that you want to check in terms of potential offenders would be that list. And that's basically the bill. There have been numerous discussions and various amendments. As you all know, probably the parole board has a proposal that's similar to this, although it has a time limited, I think it's, 5 years right now they're proposing. And there are a number of amendments that are being tossed around. We've had long meetings about the issue. I wanted to just bring before you the idea that we think law enforcement needs to have access to some information about prior sex offenders in order to solve current sex offense crimes. With that, I'll turn it over to Sheriff Tarno.
Madam Chair.
Jack.
I might add that in your files you'll find a set of amendments. They are dated May 1st, 1989, submitted by Sheriff Vernal Tarno. These amendments were the result of a working group that has been meeting with Sheriff Tarno and some other folks, including folks from LEDS. And you'll find those in your file.
Okay. Sheriff, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. About 2 years ago, this question surfaced in Coos County when we were informed that a gentleman had been released from the California State Penitentiary System named Singleton. Mr. Singleton had been convicted of chopping off the arms of a 11-year-old girl after raping the young child and leaving her for dead. It came to head in our county because word had came to us that this gentleman was going to be appointed a caretaker at a retreat directly across from Camp Easter Seal, a camp retreat for handicapped children. And in checking on this individual to find out where he was at, because California has had a statute similar to what we are proposing here for at least 30 years that I'm aware of, California gave us the last known address was en route to Florida. And from that point on, I don't think anyone knows where Mr. Singleton is at. Senator Bradbury alluded to the fact that a person who commits a sex crime doesn't change his spots. They will continue to commit those crimes at the opportunities whenever they avail themselves. All we're trying to do is track those individuals, so at least if we have a heinous crime of this type, then any jurisdiction in our state will have a starting point within which to conduct an investigation. I think that we've been joined at the table by Representative Walt Schroeder from the House side. Walter?
Great.
Thank you. Hi, Bill. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm just here to show my support for this bill. Last summer, during the Interim Committee on Education, I learned something that was rather shocking. Apparently, schools in Oregon do not oftentimes check to see if a person has been a sexual offender from another state. And we found out that sometimes a person will commit a sexual offense. Maybe they're convicted, maybe they just are let go and come out to Oregon and are now working in some of our schools. When I asked the director of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission if they'd ever checked the background of these people, he indicated they did not have the time or the staff to do this. This is frightening, that people from other states that can be either convicted or have been involved in a sex crime can come to Oregon and be allowed to teach in our schools without somebody catching them. I think this may help to stop a little bit of that. So therefore, I'm supporting this measure.
Have you seen the amendments, or the proposed amendments, Representative Schroeder? Well, originally, one of the bills that came forward required people to register with the local authorities, and obviously, if someone wanted to avoid doing that, they just wouldn't bother doing that. And so we hope our amendments will do a better job at making sure that they were actually on in the LEDS filing system so that you didn't rely on just the person who chose not to go to the local authorities from some other state, so we would have a much more, finality in terms of tracking. And I guess I'd ask the sheriff whether you think these amendments are something that you think are appropriate. And I do. Jack just sent me notes that it doesn't cover people from other states, but actually, the LEDS would have access if other states. If other states, in fact, inputted into the LEDS,
sure.
You could.
In my conversation, Madam Chair, with the Attorney General's office in California, they said if Oregon had a reciprocal bill or law of this type in our state, then they could require that individual to register in our state if they were to move from California.
That's really an advantage for the LEDS system of using that as a basis, I think. So, thank you.
One of the another issue that I would like to bring to your attention is that this particular bill addresses some five individual acts of sex crimes, a few of which are considered Class A misdemeanors, which means that they would spend up to a year in a local county jail if convicted. One of the amendments proposed by the State Parole Board would omit those individuals from being registered as a sex offender simply because they would be a misdemeanor or county jail status and perhaps not have a condition of parole or probation attached to them. Our point is to broaden as much of the coverage as we can and target those individuals who have the propensity for continually committing these crimes. Another point that I would like to mention also is that there is no time frame within which a sex offender is going to stop committing their crimes. It can occur at any point in time from the time they're 9, 10, 12 years old up until the time they are deceased.
Great.
I think with that,
thank you very much. Thanks. Then let's move to Lloyd Smith and Cy Kornbrot. Come on up, Cy and Lloyd.
Okay. Cy Kornbrot, Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. I just wanted to give you some of the technical aspects of the use of the lead system. I have discussed this at length with Sheriff Tarno prior to these amendments being submitted. We are unique in this state with the lead system, with a system that clearly identifies offenders by NCIC offense codes, which indicate the MO. There's different codes for instance, molesters of boys, molesters of girls, rapists of adult women, sodomy by sex, that type of thing, so that we can even draw a finer line on MO. You don't have to just go through stacks of registration. We can also keep the addresses up. There was some concern on my part, and there was some concern expressed about the amount of work for parole and probation officers. Under any system of registering sex offenders, there is additional work for parole and probation officers. If it's a registration in a police department, you have to get the proof of that and put it in the file, and each time the person changes, you have to enter that in the file. This way, what we'll do is just merely modify our notifier that we have, and I have in the back pages of my testimony, I've included some examples of the notifiers. That we use. We did add here that a person who is discharged from prison would have a notifier entered. I don't see that many sex offenders being discharged from prison at the end of their term. There will be some, of course. Spread out throughout the state, of those who change addresses, that would probably, in the busiest office in the state, would be maybe one a month coming in to record a change of address, which the duty officer could do. So I don't see that as any tremendous amount of work. And yet we have a more efficient system that does keep track of these people, and I endorse what Sheriff Tarno said, that we really do need to keep track of where people are, keep track for, and not rely on their self-reporting the issue. Rely on a system that is proactive rather than reactive. Have them not under the other system if they don't report. Nobody has the resources to go out and check addresses to see if people still really live there. And this system, all of those under supervision, which is probably about 90% of them, the parole and probation officer, as soon as they didn't report and as soon as they move, would check on them and get a warrant out for their arrest. And hopefully we could intervene before great streams of sex crimes occurred.
I need to understand what kind of supervision is provided when a person is discharged.
There would be no supervision. Normally, if a person is discharged, there's no supervision.
That's what I thought.
Under this bill, what would happen would be, as the person was discharged, they'd say, where are you going to live? And he'd say, well, I'm going to live at such and such an address. And they would enter one of these notifiers with the ORO, which is the return, to the nearest parole and probation office. That person would be notified to come in if he moved, report that change of address. The duty officer would modify that EPR.
As I read the bill, I see under Section 2, Sub 1, these are the amendments to the bill, the proposed
right.
amendments. When a person is discharged, the official in charge is supervising that person. Well, you just told me there isn't anybody in charge of supervising.
No, we're just talking about that refers to people who are under active supervision.
That isn't the way it reads, however. It says when a person is discharged, paroled, or released on any form of supervised release, the official in charge of supervising the person shall obtain this information.
Okay, so that would be
all
discharged from the prison.
If discharged from the supervision, it would just be the office.
Okay. Then down in Section 3, Sub 2, during the five-year period after the person is released on probation or discharged by the court, whenever he changes residence, he shall provide his new address in writing.
To the agency.
What if he doesn't? What sanctions is there?
There are no sanctions at this time. I had thought about putting sanctions in. The problem is we have the sentencing guidelines coming in. The sanctions are liable. I don't know whether they would have a fiscal impact or not. My interest is seeing that this bill, that a basic tracking device gets in. If the committee feels that there should be sanctions as a legislative function, I have no quarrel with that decision, that failure. Those people who are under supervision, there is no problem with sanction because that would be a violation, obviously. For that, I don't see that many being off supervision. The great majority of sex offenders have long periods of supervision that, if they are still violating, which most are, they don't complete it. They return with great regularity. I think we're talking about a few cases. I don't think we're talking about very many cases. But that's of course, a decision that's up to this body.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thanks very much for your willingness to come. Lloyd.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lloyd Smith, manager of the Law Enforcement Data System. And very short testimony. We're not here to support or oppose the bill, but basically to say that if it goes through the way it has been amended, then it looks like it would be workable from the LED's point of view. The question that I have, that I'm sure others have, is what happens after 5 years? And that's not addressed in the amendments. It's not indicated whether the...
Right. My guess is that we're going to have to look at that at a later date. Let's see if we can implement the first 5 years, and then we'll talk about what happens after the second 5 years, frankly, if we get... That's probably ought to take first step at a time. But we'll talk about that in work session then.
Okay.
You think you can manage the bill as it is, as it stands then?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lloyd. Other questions? Senator Springer.
If you folks are contacted, as you may have already been, for fiscal impact, do you anticipate any fiscal impact from...
No, not as the amendments are written.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thanks very much. Elise Clausen and Vic Mann and Steve Anderson, why don't we kind of get people lined up in that order? We've got a lot of folks today.
Anderson doesn't want to testify.
Okay. He's out. Okay. Elise, why don't you go ahead, please.
Okay. For the record, my name is Elise Clausen. I represent the Department of Corrections. I wanted to just express one concern that the department had with this bill, and that was in the areas in the amendments that refer to discharge. We are concerned that the Department of Corrections essentially has no custody of these people and that we should not register these people or do that once they are discharged from our custody. As far as the rest of the bill, in terms of our officers doing the work with the LED system, we're neutral on that and don't have any real concern on the rest of the bill. Our only concern was once someone was actually discharged from custody.
It's not your job any longer to keep talking to them. Right. Thank you. Senator Schumer, do you have any questions about that?
I guess she was posing the same problems that I'm having with the bill.
Well, I think you've got a certain... You can't...
Yeah.
Right.
There are limits.
Well, I guess I would ask, when you discharge a person...
I want to interrupt you in that first discharge, where it's going to have to be changed, so you have your finger on the bill.
Yeah.
That's a discharge from prison. What you need to be addressing yourself to is the second discharge, when they discharge them off of the custody.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There's a technical error on the first discharge that we need to deal with. That's discharge from prison.
Okay. Regarding the first one, then the previous witness testified that it would not be a big burden when discharged from prison to just enter the data into the LED system. Is that a problem, do you think? I know it's not within your duties, because once you're discharged, you're discharged. But am I missing something here?
Well, I think the question is when you're discharged from supervision entirely.
That's right. And if in fact, you're discharged out of prison and you're not put on supervision, we'd have the same issue.
That's my question.
Yes.
Because that does happen, too. you're discharged from prison, you've finished your sentence, and out you go.
Not very regular.
That's fairly rare. Generally speaking, they do go on parole status. But if, in fact, essentially, we're speaking to the issue of being discharged from our custody. If they're discharged directly from prison and they're not any longer a part of our custody or discharged off probation or parole, then we would not want to continue registering those people.
You wouldn't want to even put that initial data into the database?
It would have probably gone in prior to them going to prison.
Oh, I see. In other words, it'd be new information gathering, and you just don't.
That would be my understanding.
Should do. Okay. Same regarding 7-3, you were discharged by the court. Your jurisdiction ends, and you shouldn't have further duties.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mann.
For the record, my name is Vic Mann, and I'm representing the City of Eugene and the Department of Public Safety. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I've submitted written testimony, and I'll go straight to the particulars. The City of Council was concerned in the original bill about a provision that provided some sort of time limit to registration. The amendments appear to take care of that, even though perhaps a five-year limit is too short. And the amendments to put this registration on LEDS tie in nicely with a repeat offender program that we are doing in our city. The other points that I would like to just make, it is some concern to us that there are no sanctions involved in this, but obviously we would prefer to have some sort of registration. The out-of-state registration is an issue that should be considered. One of our particular concerns that came out of this is a specific case where we caught a repeat offender, or it was a misdemeanor, and one of the reasons he gave for coming to Oregon was because he did not have to register. And the fact that misdemeanors are possibly included, I think it does not detract at all from the bill. If you want a classic case of how the misdemeanor can lead to the felonies, I've referred to it in the written testimony, the I-5 killer, Randall Woodfield, is a classic example of a exposer who went to more serious crimes. The last thing is I would ask the study group, and perhaps this has already been discussed, but ORS 163.670 and 163.673 are not included in your definition, and those are sex offenses dealing with exploitation of children and perhaps should be included. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you for your input. We have your written testimony here. That's all the folks who are interested in testifying currently on Senate Bill 667, unless there's somebody else who... Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 667. Are you ready? Okay, then... let's move to Senator Hill's going to wait a few minutes. Senate Bill 444. I wanted to get this one out of the way. He's here on 444. Okay, well then let's go ahead and move to the death penalty issue, and we'll send for Representative Clark, who's around the corner in judiciary, I think, and call up Myron Hall, and we'll send for Kelly.
Which bill are we talking about?
We're gonna do the bills. They'll be 729, 447, and 690. Well, we have two people on. Myron Hall is signed up on all three bills, so I'd ask him to start with 447, Mr. Hall, and then we'll have Kelly Clark, Representative Clark, come in and deal with 729 with you, and then we'll move to 690. Please.
Madam Chairman, I'm Myron Hall, 1222 31st Court, Northwest Salem, Oregon. I'm representing both the United Methodist Church and the Oregon Coalition to Oppose the Death Penalty. You asked me to specifically talk about 447. Let me summarize just a bit of my testimony, which applies to all three of them, and then
good.
I'll
Good, that would
comment.
Be helpful. We appreciate
so
that.
So I won't take as much of your time as needed. The coalition has five principles by which they oppose, they are in favor of abolishing the death penalty. Four of those are statistically oriented. One of them is not. The first one, which is the one of reverence of life, which is quite another matter. There's a story about a pastor whose 27-year-old daughter was assaulted by five men. They beat her, they raped her, they left her to die. And the pastor naturally wanted to kill the man, and he said so. But instead he pleaded, "I don't want to be a killer. Keep the killer in me penned up. Don't make killing legal." Now, it's currently fashionable to talk about ethics in government, and you can talk about that. But it's seldom we get to the level of who we are and what we want for our civilization. What way do we want it to go? And that's why murder is such a sensitive subject, because it touches us where all of us live. Now, in terms of Senate Bill 447, we're opposed to that because it simply adds another element in the current legislation. And since we're opposed to the death penalty in the first place, we're not supporting the legislation. 690 does, in fact, exempt mentally retarded, and therefore we support that. Our basic bill and our bill is 729, which would abolish the death penalty completely. I think you probably understand where I'm coming from. I'll answer any questions if you have them.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Brennan.
Can you give me a rationalization for a 30-year sentence to the killer of the Radiman girl?
Well, we are proposing a bill which would completely abolish the idea of being able to have the 30-year sentence. And therefore, we don't propose a rationalization for that. However, I presume the legislature, in its wisdom, has decided that 30 years is, in fact, sufficient time for punishment, for retribution. You've got to make a decision as to where you draw lines, and that's where the line has been drawn.
I would say that in that particular case, I'm not sure that the legislature has made that decision at all. It's a matter of prosecution and court.
Prosecution?
Cases. Yes. Senator Hamby.
Thank you, Madam Chair, colleagues. For the record, I'm Jeanette Hamby, Senate District 5. I'd like to speak briefly to Senate Bill 447 initially, if I may, and lead you through a little packet of information that hopefully you can each find in your folder. When the idea occurred, when I received the information from the state of Washington, and that was the middle of last year, as far as the number, just the sheer number of capital cases that they had been through, how many were on death row, recognizing that they had an option, and that's exactly how Senate Bill 447 is drafted. They had an option for their capital cases of either death or true life. Not the current life that we experience here in Oregon today, but true life. I call your attention to a handout on my stationery that looks like this. Today on death row in Oregon, we had 18 as of Friday morning, and I understand Virginia, I think there was a Coos County individual added to that list, so we now have 19 on death row in Oregon versus 7 as of Friday on death row in the state of Washington. We've shown you California stats, 251. As well as, and you can compare that population. True life in Oregon, of course, we have 0. Washington has placed 63 individuals on true life. The pipeline, of course, are those individuals that are facing capital charges and are waiting to be heard. The Senate Bill 447 does not speak to the moral issue of death, but rather the economic impact to the state of Oregon. I call your attention also to the chart that shows the 11 levels of appeal currently facing any death penalty individual. and the fact that many states, including Tennessee, and I do have a handout of Tennessee's proclamation and why their Sentencing Commission review identified the horrendous economic impact of the death penalty, and citing studies that had been done, for instance, in Pennsylvania, that the cost of one case running between $5 and $7 million each. This, of course, just the sheer costs, of course, do not speak to the fact that Amnesty International has identified 23, if I recall, 23 cases erroneously put to death, and the actual offender has come forward. There are other handouts as far as the costs go, and I guess the basic argument put forth in this bill is to allow juries, providing the same questions are responded to affirmatively, allow juries the option of either the death penalty or a true life sentence. You should have amendments, Senate Bill 447-2, in your handout. Solicitor General Virginia Linder is here with me at the stand. She has identified two
the American Jewish Committee, the National Lawyers Guild, American Friends Service Committee, the Oregon-Idaho Conference of the United Methodist Church, Black United Front, and a variety of other individuals and organizations. We are opposed to the death penalty for one or more of the following reasons: because it violates the dignity and sanctity of human life, because innocent people have been and will be executed, because it does not and there is no evidence that the death penalty reduces the murder rate, because we know it's applied arbitrarily and discriminatorily against the poor and minorities, and because we know it's costly and diverts resources from important human services needs. While we come before you opposed to the death penalty for different reasons, we are today united in our support of Senate Bill 729 and the companion SJR 22. As you may know, the history of the death penalty in Oregon has been a roller coaster. We've twice abolished it in 1914 and in 1964, and twice reinstated it in 1980 in 1984. However, Oregonians, and I think this is important for the discussion today, have never been offered the opportunity to reflect on whether the ultimate sanction should not be death, but life without parole. We urge you, regardless of your personal feelings on the death penalty, to give the voters a chance to decide on this fair, humane, and cost-effective alternative to the tragedy of the death penalty in Oregon. It is a true life sentence. No furloughs, no parole, no work release. A person sentenced to aggravated murder will spend the rest of their natural lives in prison. And this will not be simply by statute. It will be in the Oregon Constitution as an amendment to Article 1, Section 40. We know about the financial costs, or at least we have a better idea. Each prosecution will cost at least a minimum of $500,000 through the trial stage. And those are figures from the governor's office. More likely, a $1.2 million is a more accurate figure per case in Oregon. Remember, we've been through 20, we've got 45 in the pipeline, and we are putting cases in the system at a geometric and not an arithmetic rate. We are putting cases in the system at a rate comparable to Texas, Florida, Alabama, and the high death penalty states. We know not only about the financial cost, but we know that the cost of executing the innocent is with us. Today, Randall Dale Adams, who came within days of being executed in Texas, and James Richardson, and this just happened last week in Florida, walk free men, their convictions having been overturned. In Adams' case, on the basis of perjured testimony and prosecutorial misconduct. You also may be interested in knowing that recently in Clackamas County, a jury convicted a migrant worker of murder in a non-capital case. Later wanted to reconsider the verdict, but it was too late. Three jurors felt that the evidence did not support a verdict of guilty. The Court of Appeals refused to upset the verdict. Whether you agree or disagree with the death penalty, the time has come to give the voters an opportunity to decide the issue in a way never presented before. By November 1990, Oregonians will have had 5 years to reflect on the death penalty. Given the costs in human and financial terms, the voters deserve the chance to reconsider their decision. As their elected representatives, you owe them at least the opportunity to vote on this life or death issue. A couple of brief comments on Senate Bill 447. As you may know, House Bill 3303, as amended, passed out of House Judiciary Committee Friday, and that bill provides three options: the death penalty, life without parole, and life without a referral clause to the people. As a coalition, we are neutral on that bill. We are not taking a position in favor or against. The reason for the neutral position is obviously we can't oppose a bill that has the potential of saving lives. On the other hand, we can't support a bill that retains the death penalty. As to 447, our position is the same but for the referral clause. Article 1, Section 40 provides that the penalty for aggravated murder shall be death or a minimum as prescribed by law. That means the legislature can prescribe the minimum as life without the possibility of parole. There is no legal requirement that 447 or 3303 be referred to the voters. We would oppose a referral. We certainly want to make our case in front of the people, and we want you to give us the chance to make the case in front of the people. But give the people a real choice. Give the people a real choice between the death penalty or life without parole. This legislature wants to give the juries the choice of life without parole. It can do it in 447 without a referral clause, or when and if it deals with House Bill 3303. The coalition also stands in strong support of Senate Bill 690. As you may know, the U.S. Supreme Court has this issue under review. In answer to Senator Brenneman's question, there are a number of people, certainly over 14 or 15 across the country, who have been sentenced to die whose IQs would probably meet the Oregon statutory standard. And I'm very happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Senator Brenneman.
Mr. Kramer, where were you in 64?
Where was I in 64? Somewhere in school.
I was a first-time voter in the state of Oregon, and I would disagree that you may be technically correct in saying this has never been presented in this fashion before, but the arguments in 64 were the same you're giving now. I voted to abolish the death penalty in 64, but there's never any mention of parole. The arguments were always in favor of the person not being executed in Oregon, that they would do full-term life sentence in the Oregon criminal system. Never any possibility of parole.
Where we are different today is the proposal is to put in the Oregon Constitution life imprisonment without parole, and that's the crucial distinction.
Thank you very much. Bob?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bob Castagna, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference, which is the public policy office of the Archdiocese of Portland and the Diocese of Baker. The Oregon Catholic Conference is a member of the Oregon Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and I'm delighted to be able to appear today with Representative Kelly Clark and Mark Kramer. The Oregon Catholic Conference and the United States Catholic Conference proceed from a basis which the Church calls the consistent ethic of life. The dignity and sanctity of human life is the framework or the cornerstone of the Church's public policy positions as regards human life, holding the sanctity and dignity of human life from conception until natural death. And I'm proud to say that in 1986, we hosted a conference at the University of Portland on the consistent ethic of life, and were addressed by Cardinal Joseph Bernardin and Senator Mark Hatfield through videotape. The senator shares this perspective, and I'm also delighted to indicate that Representative Kelly Clark, to my right, shares the same perspective. We come to you with the Oregon Catholic Conference bishops having in 1978 and in 1984 issued statements against the death penalty when it appeared on the ballot for the people of the state. And there are values, Judeo-Christian values, in the abolition of capital punishment. And in their 1980 statement, the United States Catholic Conference of Bishops stated that we maintain that abolition of the death penalty would promote values that are important to us as citizens and as Christians. First, abolition sends a message that we can break the cycle of violence, that we need not take life for life, that we envisage more humane and more hopeful and effective responses to the growth of violent crime. Second, that abolition of capital punishment is also a manifestation of our belief in the unique worth and dignity of each person from the moment of conception, a creature made in the image and likeness of God. Third, abolition of the death penalty is further testimony to our conviction, a conviction that we share with the Judaic and Islamic traditions, that God is indeed the Lord of life. And fourth, we believe that abolition of the death penalty is most consonant with the example of Jesus, who both taught and practiced the forgiveness of injustice, and who came to give his life as a ransom for many. I would like to read just one paragraph in this document that says, "We do not propose the abolition of capital punishment as a simple solution to the problems of crime and violence. As we observed earlier, we do not believe that any simple and comprehensive solution is possible. We affirm that there is a special need to offer sympathy and support for the victims of violent crime and their families. Our society should not flinch from contemplating the suffering that violent crime brings to so many when it destroys lives, shatters families, and crushes the hopes of the innocent. The recognition of this suffering should not lead to demands for vengeance, but to a firm resolution that help be given to the victims of crime and that justice be done fairly and swiftly. The care and support that we give to the victims of crime should be both compassionate and practical. The public response to crime should include the relief of financial distress caused by crime and the provision of medical and psychological treatment to the extent that these are required and helpful. It is a special responsibility of the church to provide a community of faith and trust in which God's grace can heal the personal and spiritual wounds caused by crime and in which we can all grow by sharing one another's burdens and sorrows. As a personal note, I've been involved in the death penalty practically since I arrived in the state in 1975. As a practicing attorney, I walked into court with clients who were thought to have, on the basis of probable cause, were accused of crimes, and we walked out of court with a finding of not guilty. The death penalty is irreversible once the state executes it. I would ask that we not make an ultimate decision which is irreversible by the people of the state acting in our name, but instead enact and pass Senate Bill 729, refer the matters to the voters, achieve a state of financial savings that might be available through this measure. But I think more important than any financial savings is that we, not as a state, commit an act of violence, ultimate violence, in response to a horrible act of violence that has been created in society. Let us not, as a people of this state, become killers ourselves. Let us act in a restrained and judicious fashion, in a way that comports with our own dignity and our own respect for life, and that reflects the best values of the people of the state of Oregon. Thank you very much.
Quick questions? Thank you very much. I would ask, I'm assuming you have, some of you have signed up on 690 as well, and so I'm intending to, that will suffice, if you wouldn't mind.
Thank you.
We've got, I'll call Claudia Burton, Dr. James Lindemann, and Joanna Starr on Senate Bill 690, and then I think that's the bulk of the... Senate Bill 690. Quickly.
You look great.
You've got about eight minutes, please.
I'm Claudia Burton of Salem, Oregon, representing the ACLU of Oregon, testifying in behalf of Senate Bill 690, which would abolish capital punishment for the mentally retarded. It's amazing how recent an issue this is. Only in the 60s did this country and its criminal justice system begin to face the question of how to deal with someone who is as mentally handicapped as a person who meets our statutory definition of mentally retarded is. I have with me today Dr. James Lindemann from the Oregon Health Sciences Center, a psychologist who will comment and answer any questions you may have about the degree of deficit that is involved in a person who meets our statutory definition of mental retardation. But suffice it to say here that a person would have, generally speaking, an IQ of 70 or less and have deficits in adaptive behavior. This is a standard met by probably less than 3% of the population generally. Since in the 60s we were on our way toward a moratorium with the death penalty, people didn't really at that time grapple with the issue of whether or not a mentally retarded person was fully morally culpable for his acts, so adult and responsible that it was fair to sentence them to our ultimate penalty, death. That issue has arisen, though, in the mid-80s. It arose in 1986 publicly in Georgia when just a few hours before execution, it was discovered that Jerome Bowden had an IQ in the low 60s. In part in response to the public outcry surrounding that event, Mr. Bowden was executed. The Georgia legislature enacted legislation abolishing capital punishment for the mentally retarded. ACLU opposes capital punishment for the mentally retarded, both because we feel that such persons do not have the degree of mental development that makes it fair to impose that penalty on them, and then secondly, because at a large number of steps in the whole process of investigation and trial, a person so handicapped simply cannot participate, so that there are very grave questions about the fairness of such a penalty in this case. I've included detail on that in my testimony. I also have included a number of references to actual convicted defendants. And if many of you, as I, probably are not familiar with what this handicap consists of in terms of functioning. But I've included on the back page and then in the testimony as well some references to statements made by people who have been convicted of murder and who meet this standard. And it really is fairly stunning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Perhaps you were in the audience, Claudia, when I raised the question regarding Senate Bill 690, whether an amendment would be appropriate to commit a person mentally retarded to life imprisonment without possibility of parole. The bill as presently drafted doesn't contemplate that. Do you have any reaction to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, yes, I would be opposed to that amendment, Senator Shoemaker. For me, the question really initially has to do with moral culpability and whether the death penalty is appropriate. Now, sort of if I was given my druthers, I suppose I would rather have someone in prison without possibility of parole than executed in such a circumstance. I don't assume that a person who's mentally retarded is so morally reprehensible, plus so assuredly dangerous forever, that life without possibility of parole is an appropriate sentence.
You, of course, are giving your personal opinion and not that of the ACLU. I think I might request, I assume your testimony was on behalf of the ACLU, and
yes.
I meant my question to you personally. I was not trying to, but I'm following that up with the request that maybe the ACLU would like to consider that and develop an official position on it. I don't know whether there's time to do that or not.
I think there'll be plenty of time since we're going to do
okay. I think it's an appropriate request.
I'll be glad to ask them. Thank you,
Thank
Senator
you.
Shoemaker.
Dr. Lindemann?
Dr. James Lindemann, and I would like to comment on some of the significance of mental retardation for this issue. As Ms. Burton has said, mental retardation is defined as IQ 70. That equates to an operating mental age some below 11 years of age. If you will look for a moment just at some of the ordinary kinds of functions associated with a person operating below 11 years of age, for example, they cannot read an adult newspaper story, tell time to the exact minute, use a payphone, or most importantly, weigh the consequences of actions before making decisions. Some of the most significant limitations that flow from mental retardation are those that have to do with mental processing, the thinking process. Persons who are mentally retarded typically have difficulty making inferences, that is, analyzing the meaning of a new situation with which they're confronted. They have difficulty generalizing. They tend to learn one thing at a time and in a very literal way. And if it needs to be applied somewhere else, then they need to learn it there. They have difficulty understanding the relationship between cause and effect. They have difficulty predicting consequences. They then have a difficulty in generating or coming up with a range of behaviors to respond to a new situation. It's novel to them, and where we might think, well, I can handle it this way, that kind of range of ways of handling is typically not available. And finally, having experience in not understanding what they're asked to cope with from time to time, that fear of the unknown leads to difficulty in controlling impulsive behavior. All of those things contribute to a level of both understanding and judgment that does not equate itself with a level of responsibility or moral culpability that deserves the...
How reliably can you tell, can you gauge the IQ of an individual based on our current law and the standard? Is that...
With relative reliability, the current the laws typically call for both the use of a standardized intelligence test and the use of adaptive behavior, so that one looks at the way the person is actually functioning as well as their pure intellectual process.
So you're convinced that the jury can make a legitimate determination of whether someone in fact met the standard of...
With adequate professional consultation, I think that is at a quite acceptable level of reliability.
Thank you. Are there other questions?
Sorry, yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, the statute defining mental retardation has three different definitions within it.
Mm-hmm.
The first of those is that mental retardation means significantly sub-average general intellectual functioning concurrently with deficits in adaptive behavior. And I think that probably is the one you were speaking to.
Correct.
Primarily. It goes on to say, persons of borderline intelligence may be considered mentally retarded if there is also serious impairment of adaptive behavior. And I'd like you to give us some enlightenment on what that means and how it differs from the first standard. And then the final standard is that mental retardation is synonymous with mental deficiency, and perhaps you could comment on that.
The last is the most simple, and that is the term has been universally changed from mental deficiency to mental retardation, including the names of many organizations, for example.
Okay, that's what I thought, just to get that clear.
Your other point, however, of what is borderline intelligence, if I may use numbers, and things usually aren't that quite that literal, mental retardation is below IQ 70. Borderline intelligence is IQ 70 to 80. In order for a finding of mental retardation to be made on a person with an IQ between 70 and 80, it would be necessary to find them grossly deficient in their adaptive behavior skills. Adaptive behavior skills are usually defined in terms of social skills, communication skills, and daily living skills, the kind of street sense and how you do on the street corner or at home. They would need to be grossly deficient in order to then combine that with an IQ, say, that did fall between 70 and 80, and say this person is mentally retarded. Incidentally, that works both ways. There are persons who might have an IQ, let us say, of 65 or 68, who do so well in adaptive living, street sense, work perhaps, that they will be found by a professional to be not mentally retarded.
Mm-hmm.
That is the reason for pairing both intellectual functioning and adaptive living skills.
If a person has an IQ of 80, how far would one expect him to be able to go in school? Would you get through high school with that? Could you?
I suppose I can only honestly say that unfortunately you might be able to by virtue of taking all the easiest courses and being there on time and being polite. But a person, let me put it another way, a person with an IQ of 80 is ordinarily functioning at a level at approximately between 12 and 13 years of age. I would hasten to say, though, that in my professional experience and my knowledge of the literature, It is rare that a person with an IQ well up in the 70s is found to be mentally retarded.
Thank you. Do you want to start?
Thanks. Well, can I? May
oh,
I?
Senator Crocker.
I have a question of the doctor. Thank you, Madam Chair. How would you best portray the thought process of one of these individuals working up to the final decision to murder somebody?
A person probably confronted with a situation that alarmed them or frightened them, that they had not coped with before, that they didn't know how to deal with, and in a panic, acting aggressively. I have also a recent case, for example, in which I was involved, of a person who committed arson, which could have resulted in death but didn't. It was rather clear that from that person's point of view, he was setting a fire in the basement because he was mad at some people. It was clear that he did not understand that setting the fire in the basement might burn down the building, might threaten the lives of 20 people. It was an apartment building, a small apartment building. It is that lack of knowledge of the consequences, plus a lack of a repertoire of behaviors for handling situations such as we can ordinarily produce, that then is likely to lead to behavior which would ultimately bring a charge of that could involve the death sentence.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jonas.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Janice Starr, and I'm Executive Director of the Association for Retarded Citizens of Oregon. Let me say at the outset that this has been a very difficult issue for the association to deal with. Certainly as advocates for people with mental retardation, we have a feeling that those people with mental retardation who have very little ability to understand death, killing, consequences, etc., certainly should not be put to death for the commission of a crime that they do not understand. And we can see also that people frequently get to the point of being sentenced to death through the inadequacies of the criminal justice system, such as poor representation, inhumane treatment basically by people at every level that don't understand how to relate to them. And I think in that instance, this is definitely cruel and unusual punishment. But let me put some caveats on that and hit about three points very briefly. For one thing, the issue, Senator Shoemaker, of life imprisonment. In the current penal system, basically people with limited intelligence have very little chance in the penal system. They've become the victims of abuse. They frequently are always in trouble from not understanding the rules, the regulations, not behaving in the manner that they're expected to behave, and they're accused of being noncompliant, and I think eventually frequently become noncompliant, and it's a very much a no-win situation inside the penal system. Now, it has been decided in at least one case that people inside the penal system who have mental retardation have civil rights, the Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons under the Act called the Civil Rights for Institutionalized Persons Act. So if they're in the penal system for life, the state is going to be liable for providing them with habilitative type things. That if the penal system can work for them, it can only work if they're given special habilitative, special educational, and other types of services that would make them able to survive within the penal system. I think a bigger issue, however, to us is when we categorize people with mental retardation, paint them all with one brush, as it were, put them all into one category, we're doing a disservice to people with mental retardation. There are many, many people with mental retardation who have full knowledge of good and evil, full knowledge of right and wrong, full knowledge of their actions, and can understand consequences very well. 89% of the people with mental retardation are in that category called mild mental retardation. And I would say certainly when we get below that category called mild mental retardation, that we have some serious issues to deal with as to whether people do know the difference between right and wrong. In recent years, there's been a major effort on the part of people with mental retardation, their families, and their advocates, such as the ARC, to integrate into the community at large. These people are no more naturally prone to violent crime than any other segment of society or any other member of the community. They work, they go to school, they pay taxes, they engage in all sorts of normal life activities. Yet there still exists a fear and a paranoia on the part of the general populace. I think this comes largely out of the confusion between disabilities, the mental illness disability, alcohol and drug abuse disabilities, and mental retardation. They're real different populations. A person with mental retardation will not necessarily behave in antisocial ways. And this makes it real tough to make a decision on this issue, because when we accept them from the laws of the land, even capital punishment, then we are setting them apart as a population, and I think we're feeding into this prejudice and this mythology that's been created out of the confusion as to what mental retardation really is. And it's a fear that never should have been existed in the first place. It never should have existed. But if we accept this population from the laws of the land, then we're feeding this fear. Finally, I'd just like to say that while this is not an issue in front of you right now, that the real changes which need to take place are in the criminal justice system as a whole. There is an incredible lack of understanding at every level, whether it's police officers, the court system, the judges included, attorneys, the penal system, the guards, the wardens, et cetera, do not understand mental retardation and what a person with mental retardation needs in the way of either habilitation or in the way of being made to understand what they have done and what the consequences might be. Again, the services always need to, the treatment of people with mental retardation need to be very individualized. We cannot categorize, paint with a broad brush an entire population like that. Like I said, it's been a tough issue for the ARC to struggle with, but I think at this juncture we would really discourage the passage of this bill for these reasons.
But you're essentially opposed to the bill. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all. Senate Bill 910, Senator Hill.
Madam Chair, Senator Hill is preparing to testify. May I read in the record a short statement from the Oregon State Bar, which I think
one
of the other witnesses. This was resolution number 10. It was adopted